All right, motion has been made. Is there a second? Seconded. Is there any dissent? Seeing none. All right, motion approved. Great. We have approved our meeting minutes. We're now moving to reports of officer and committee updates. We'll go ahead with our executive committee. Hello, Nicholas.
Hi. So a couple things to update on. First, I'm announcing the resignation of the DISC committee chair, Ayushi Kapoor. I'd like to thank Ayushi for all that she and her committee have done over the past year. And today, kind of under new business, which isn't written here, we'll be filling that vacancy so we can get that committee back up and rolling. Today, kind of stepping through the agenda, we'll have a presentation from the Thompson Consolidated Area Transit Incorporated, TCAT. Welcome. Thank you for joining us. It'll be led by Matthew Rosenblum Jones, the general manager for TCAT, Trevor Jensen, the planning and scheduling manager, as well as Heidi Poise, the communications and marketing manager, all of whom are here to join us today. I also want to say that thanks to hard work from the Office of the Assemblies and an expedient email from Ocean, we communicated the results of Resolution 6 on the final express activity policy recommendation from the CTEA the night of January 22nd, the date, or sorry, January 27th, the date that it was passed. So haven't heard anything from the president as of yet, but we did all we could, and now we wait. Yeah, and I think that's it from the executive committee. I'll pass it back to you.
Thank you. If there's no any questions, comments, and concerns, we'll now move into our operations and staffing committee. Xander, whenever you're ready.
All right. So the main thing from us at the operations and staffing committee is we have revised the bylaws for GPSA. So we are so that is actually included in the packet right now, more or less in its final form. We are still finding some copy editing errors, but those will be updated by next time. So if you have a chance, take a look through it, and I believe we will have some time for discussion. So if you have any edits or things that look weird or anything like that, at any level, whether that's like copy editing or I think this committee should be disbanded, let me know. And yeah, so we'll talk about that later, but otherwise, just rolling along.
Oh, any questions?
Can you clarify if this will be passed today?
Oh, this will not be passed today, but because this is like this organization's bylaws, so we can't pass this in the same day that the legislation is presented. So I present this here so that you have time to not only give me feedback today, but also between and at the next session.
All right. Do we have any further questions, comments, and or concerns? Seeing none, we'll now move into our appropriations committee. No updates have been sent over thus far. So in that case, we'll move into our communications committee updates. Andy, whenever you're ready. Nothing to report. All that's been sent out has been communicated, so please make sure you check that out. We'll now move into the Finance Commission committee. Hello, Anna. Are you ready? Also, no updates. Thank you so much. We'll now move into our Student Advocacy Committee updates. That will be Shunika, who is not, or is she in Zoom? Doesn't seem like it. Well, they've been very busy with all the solutions, so we can give a break. All right. At the moment, we don't have a DISC chair, but we will be having that soon in our new business. So at the moment, no updates on there. We'll now move into our programming board updates. Eva, whenever you're ready.
So the programming board met last week for the first meeting of the semester. Our advisor, Claude, came into the meeting and was able to meet everybody for the first time. The contract is signed with the Statler, so we have solidified May 8th of this year for the spring gala. And the committees within the committee are all made and are starting to do their work for the gala. That's everything.
Thank you. We have a question. Yes.
Do we know when the first ticket drop is roughly going to be?
Yes. 1 second.
One.
1 second, please. I'm going to pull up the ticket drop dates for you.
Ultimately.
Yes.
Are they all the same price of each date? Or... Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I don't know. Some people are like, either during the early days and more expensive than today. So
this is a top tier event.
Okay. Ticket drop dates are. Not in this one. I have many agendas. March 7th, March 14th, March 28th.
All right. Yes, one final.
Do you know what the total number of tickets being sold for this space is?
500.
In total or within each?
In total.
In total. Mm-hmm. 500 tickets in total. Tickets being sold on March 7th, 14th, and 28th for the GPSA Gala. So mark your calendars for everyone here and everyone that's reading the meeting minutes. If there are no other questions, comments, and or concerns, we'll now move over to our Faculty Team Advising and Mentorship Award Committee. Jason, whenever you're ready.
Yep, we met last week. Things are moving along. There, you should have seen the communique, two things. The first, which thankfully at the top of the list, was another nomination for faculty speaker at the graduate recognition ceremony, I suppose. So if you've got a faculty who you think credible speaker, they would blow everyone's socks off, let us know. And then that'll close in about a month. And then also closing in about a month is the nominations for the awards. As mentioned, that's the main duty that we do here at the FATMAC. So at the very end, just make sure to nominate a faculty, graduate student, or postdoc who you think is a good research mentor, advisor, and or cool person.
If there's no questions, we'll now move over to our last but certainly not least updates from the graduate school, Dean Boyle.
Two really brief things today. One is I'd like to thank the members of the GPSA who've been helping us out with two different searches, one being for our career support person in the predominantly humanities and the social sciences. The second, for those who are helping on the selection of my successor, and that person will start July 1. So that's well underway. The second thing is we are well underway with recruitment for students to be entering for fall 2025. And so I just wanted to put that on your radar, and thanks to all of you who are helping with those efforts as well.
Thank you. If there are no other questions, that will conclude our reports for the officers and committees. We'll now move into our presentation. As mentioned in the executive committee updates, we do have the Tompkins Consolidated Area Transit Incorporation, or Incorporated, or TCAT for short. They are here to present to all of y'all about what they do, what their general structure is, operations, and so much more. As a reminder, we did have Bridget Brady from Department of Transportation to come over last semester to talk about Cornell's perspective on things and stuff. And we are soon to hope get her again in this semester as well, but we have not had TCAT present before. So to get more greater scope on the current situation that is transportation overall, so thankful for all three speakers combining over to our GPSA meeting. So without further ado, please give a warm welcome to all of TCAT.
Everybody see the screen?
You shared it.
Oh. There we go.
Jessica, do you think you can turn off the lights by any chance? The font is kind of thin, so it might be helpful.
Is that okay?
Yep, yeah, perfect. And I guess we'll turn them on like once the presentation's over.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm not sure if there's a presentation mode, but I think everyone can see it all right. So we'll just go from here. So my name is Jaffee Rosenblum-Jones. I am the general manager of TCAT, which means I'm kind of the one who's in charge of TCAT. I've been working at TCAT for a little over a year. I started as the service development manager, which is responsible for planning and scheduling of all the routes and trips. And then I was interim general manager after our longtime general manager, Scott Vanderpool, retired. And then I was made permanent in April of 2024. So I'm relatively new to the position, but I've been in transit for a long time. Previously, I ran a transit system in northern Wisconsin. And prior to that, I worked in public transit in a number of states. I'm from Buffalo. I went to grad school at SUNY Albany. I worked in public transit in upstate New York, downstate New York, Kentucky, the Twin Cities. So I have a little bit of experience working all over in all sorts of roles, from planning to operations to general management. So I'm just going to go through a brief presentation with a little bit of information about TCAT, and then I'll open up the floor to discussion or questions. If there's any questions you have as I go through the presentation, just feel free to stop me. So just a little bit about TCAT. We traveled 1.2 million miles, or almost 1.3 million miles, in 2024, and carried 2.8 million riders in 2024. Prior to COVID, our highest year was 4 million riders, so we're about 75% where we were before COVID. We currently operate a fleet of around 53 vehicles. We're cycling some of the older vehicles out, and we're expecting to take delivery of 11 vehicles this year, new buses. So, but currently our fleet sits in the low 50s. We have 25 fixed routes and one seasonal route that operates this summer, primarily to get school children to summer camps. And we have three stakeholders or underwriters. For all intents and purposes, I would say they're the owners of TCAT. It's the City of Ithaca, Tompkins County, and Cornell University. So a little bit of history on how we got formed. Prior to 1996, there were three transit systems in Ithaca, and they were all kind of duplicating what each transit system did. And transit operates on economies of scale. So the more you consolidate and the bigger you are, the lower your cost of operation is per mile, per vehicle, per hour. So as I mentioned, there was Ithaca Transit, which was owned by the city. There was TomTran, which was owned and operated by Tompkins County, and Cornell University had its own transit system. So the three branches consolidated that formed Tompkins Consolidated Area Transit, Inc. So we are technically a private, non-for-profit corporation, unlike many transit systems in the state that are authorities or branches of county or municipal government. We're kind of a unicorn in that regard. And then we have our sister transit system, Gadabout. Gadabout provides paratransit service for those who have a disability where they cannot ride a fixed route bus, and store to door, curb to curb service. And they provide a lot of rural service for the elderly throughout Tompkins County. So that we contract with them to operate our paratransit service, which we're required to operate under the Americans with Disabilities Act. So a little bit about our funding. You know, if you look at the bottom of this graph here, you have $0, and it goes all the way up to our operating budget, which is almost $20 million. So the biggest chunk of our funding in years past came from federal operating assistance. This was primarily grants that were issued during the pandemic, CRISA and CARES, to offset lost fare revenue and higher operating costs. Those have wound down. So the bulk of our funding is really New York State operating assistance, and that will probably resume being the largest share of our operating funding. We refer to this as STOA. It's a per head and per mile calculation. So when you get on a bus, we count you, and then we count how many miles you travel, and then that gets put into a formula, and the state reimburses us for that. Cornell University has a service level agreement, which is approximately a little over $3 billion, a bulk fare payment that allows all first-year Cornell students, not necessarily freshmen, but first-years, to ride anywhere in the system using their student ID. And when you add the ridership privileges onto your ID card, that money goes to Cornell, which in turn they funnel to TCAT through the service level agreement. The underwriters provide a little over $1 million each for their local share. So in order to get federal and state funding, you have to have a local share, and then the federal or state government reimburse you for that local share. So the reimbursement rate for capital projects is for every dollar of local money, they'll give you $5 of federal money. And for every dollar of operating money, they give you two for operating money. You know, we get 6% from miscellaneous sources, you know, advertising, sales of scrap metal and vehicles. And then the rest is 4% fare box recovery rate. So that's fairly low. That number will creep up as we get ridership back on the road, but we don't make money through fares. Even at our busiest times, we were maybe making 25% of our revenue was through fares. So it means for every dollar we get in fares, there's $3 that come from other sources. Public transit hasn't really been a profitable entity in the United States since World War II. So that's why it's under the guise of the public sector. So a little bit about our routes. We have four different categories of routes. We have campus routes, which are the 81, 82, 83, which is currently suspended, and the 92. That's about 18%, 19% of our system ridership. Those routes don't leave campus. They just circulate entirely basically within Cornell. We have the connector, campus connector routes. Those connect campus to the urban core in Ithaca. That's about 55% of our ridership. That includes the 10, 30, 31, 32, 51, and 90. So the 30 is our busiest route by far. That's kind of our bread and butter. It goes downtown through campus to the mall and back. We have general urban routes. These support the city of Ithaca primarily. The 11, 13, 14, 14S, 15, 17. That's about 11, 12% of our ridership. And then we have rural routes. These go all over the county. You know, as they say, Ithaca's 10 square miles, we're surrounded by reality, and these routes operate in reality. So that's about 14% of our ridership. These are longer distance routes. They go to all of the small communities, Groton, Newfield, Aetna. So they really kind of provide a very critical service for people that live in those communities and don't have a car and need to come into the city for medical treatment or employment or groceries. They're kind of lifeline type service. So as you can see here, I'm going to zoom in a little bit so we can all see, maybe. Well, doesn't want to zoom, but if the route with the biggest bar here, right here, this is the Route 30, which is our, you know, as I mentioned, the downtown to the mall route, which is by far our busiest route. The campus routes, you can find them over here. They are a significant source of ridership, the 10 as well. So it just shows the breakdown between our different routes. But as you can see, the 30 does as much ridership as basically every other route in the system, except for the campus routes combined. That really is our bread and butter. Yeah,
I believe the Zoom thing is being covered by the closed captioning, so I think you can drag the closed captioning away to get there.
Oh, here we are. Oh thank you.
All right. Here we are.
Might be a little clearer on how our ridership is broken out throughout the system. So this slide here shows kind of our ridership and how it compares to where we were in 2019, which was pre-COVID. So we kind of have, imagine like a camel with two humps. That's kind of how our ridership is. It peaks typically in the spring and fall, and during the summer and winter break, there's a big dip when there's less activity at Cornell and Ithaca College. So this low here is, you know, probably our lowest month, which is June. June is a very quiet month. Historically, we've used that time to repair vehicles and give the drivers a vacation, but more recently, we're running more of a year-round schedule. You know, our peak in spring this year wasn't so pronounced because we were running much less service than we had previously, but in the fall, we saw a big rebound and came close to where we were pre-COVID. This green here is service reliability. So all the green are trips that we ran. Yellow are trips that we cancel, usually due to equipment problems, but sometimes because we don't have enough drivers. Severe weather, you know, we've been hit really hard with, we had three suspensions due to weather so far this year, which is unusual for us. But this is a metric of service reliability. So, you know, you can see certainly in the spring of last year, we were suffering from a lot of equipment problems that led to a lot of canceled trips. But as the year went on, we improved the reliability significantly. And then this is canceled trips by route. We do have kind of organization that goes on when we have to cancel trips. I mean, the first thing we do is we try to go to all lengths not to cancel the trip, which means trying to find an operator or a vehicle or repairing the vehicle. But in the event we have to cancel trips, we try to preserve as much of the rural service as possible because that runs so infrequently and it's critical to get those people in. So a lot of the cancellations are born in the 10, the 30, and the 81. They run more frequently than the other routes. So, you know, essentially that means delay to a journey, but it doesn't mean that the journey is impossible. While if you cancel a rural trip that might only carries a handful of riders per trip, if you cancel that trip, it means those riders can't make the trip at all. So we'd much rather have a delay than a cancellation, and that's kind of the method to how we cancel trips. So looking at, again, this is just Cornell ridership in the year of 2024. It follows that kind of two humps pattern. We do not see very much ridership in the, you know, period between Christmas and New Year's. That's very, very quiet on campus. We do operate, but the buses are primarily pretty empty. But, you know, we do kind of have those big peaks in the spring and fall. And you can see those drops between the bars. Those are weekends. So we still do a lot more business on a weekday than we do a weekend, but weekend ridership in the second half of the year grew a lot as we added a lot more service on the weekends and then late nights. Again, this is just the same chart by month. September of 2024, we moved over 300,000 people, which was our best month since the pandemic started. So we are running more service than we have been and more people are riding. But we have a lot of challenges. We had 7 Proterra battery electric buses. The frames have begun to fall apart on all the buses due to an engineering problem. So we've had to remove those from service. And what that means is that it places a lot of strain on very old diesel buses. We have a lot of buses from the 2011 model year, which is old for city buses. Some of those are creeping up on 400,000 miles. And they are old and tired, and they're also very dirty, very loud. We're trying to get those off the road with newer vehicles. But, the withdrawal of our electric fleet has put a huge strain on those older buses. So, again, we have 11 new buses that are slated to be delivered this year. 5 will be diesels and 6 will be battery electrics. And there are 2 hybrid buses that we've been awarded funding for, but there's a little bit of uncertainty given what's going on at the federal level because those are funded through federal grants. We have in this area an extremely high cost of living, and that is a deterrent to hire drivers and mechanics and puts a lot of strain on our workforce. So we've had a lot of trouble hiring bus drivers and mechanics. It takes about 8 weeks or sometimes 10 weeks to go through the full training program. There's a lot of rules and regulations that apply to the bus drivers and things that reach into their personal life about, you know, recreational activities outside of work regarding certain substances. And that can make it difficult to recruit. And again, like I mentioned, the high cost of living, oftentimes it just makes it very hard to recruit people who want to work in those types of roles here because they can go do the same job in Syracuse or Binghamton where the cost of living is much more reasonable. So we're working a lot closely with, educational pathways. We've been working with BOCES. We're attending a career fair at Alfred State, try to get new mechanics hired on. The driver hiring seems to have picked up a little bit in the last month or two, but mechanic hiring and recruitment's always been a challenge because there's a nationwide shortage of diesel mechanics, and these buses are very complicated to maintain, and even a good mechanic will take about 2 years to learn everything there is to know on a city bus. So that's the end of my little presentation, but I'm happy to answer any questions or respond to any discussion points that anyone might have.
All right, we'll be taking any questions, starting with Representative Linda.
The question, do you put chains
Wait, on... Wait, oh my god, Rosa, oh my god, I'm so sorry.
I'm sorry. I'm not kidding.
Wrong representative. Okay. I represent Raimondi, go for it.
Yeah, do you put chains on the buses?
No, we don't. The roads in this area cannot handle chains because the roads are so brittle from... You know, just a freeze thaw cycle, and they're not necessarily being paved on a regular basis. So chains would do huge amount of damage to the local roads, and the city and the state and the county would be very upset with us. In the past, we've used snow tires. We try to stay away from those. They're very expensive, and they're very, very noisy. You burn through them very quickly, and you know it's kind of a financial decision that we've made to move away from snow tires. So what we use is we use all season tires with an aggressive tread pattern. Those allow for safe operation in some conditions. More recently, we've had a lot of disruption that's been due to ice and snow, and the amount of time it's taken roadway crews to remove the ice and snow has been much longer this year than in previous years. And with the hills, we've had to make the call a few times to suspend all the service. We typically look at, you know, when there's cars off the road or a lot of accidents. And I think two suspensions we had, State Street was completely blocked, so we couldn't even operate if we wanted to. But winter weather is a big challenge for us. It's more strain on the equipment than actually extreme heat. So, you know, we always look to see what we can do to try to fight winter, but this year winter seems to be getting the better of us.
Yes.
Hi. So in one of the campus connecting routes, like 30, 31, 32, there seems to have more than 50% of the riders, right? And do you have a sense of why some of the route, like routes, especially 31, seems to be working only on weekdays? Like they don't run over weekends. Do you have a sense of why?
Yeah, it's demand-based. So, you know, we have a limited amount of resources, both from a budgetary standpoint of how much we can afford to operate, but how many drivers and vehicles that we have available. And we try to pair them with the times of day when they're most used. So 31 and 32, they serve, you know, employers that might only be open on the Monday through Friday, the airport area. So, you know, we do try to kind of match, I guess, the resources with where we have the most demand specific to that specific route. I don't know if Trevor had anything to add, because he's the one who makes all the schedules.
So the Route 31 runs weekdays only. It's mostly historical decision. We used to have a network of 70 series routes specifically for weekends. So the weekend 30 was the 70, the 32, 72, and so on and so forth. And the idea was to save on resources, and because we don't see the have the demand to operate the 31 out to Aetna and Winston Port every hour on a weekend, we encourage riders to get a 77, ride that to the mall, ostensibly do their shopping there, or alternatively transfer to Route 30. Go downtown. As far as the 32 schedule should be almost exactly the same as weekday, except there's two extra trippers in the morning and some later nights or trippers on weekdays. That is for demand management, since we get a lot of overcrowded inbound 32s from Uptown Apartments, Gaslight Village, Northwoods. Historically, as in pre-COVID, demand was high enough where we would run extra backup buses, but that just is that high commuting density volume is just not there on the weekend. But yeah, the 32 is very consistent in its ridership because on weekdays we have huge demand moving folks from downtown to some degree lower College Town up to campus, and then all that is just replaced with Target on weekends and to some degree weekend steady. So
Also, do you like sort of consider, you know, 32 maybe on a weekend, going from maybe Thurston to Kaiser Heights and then back on the 32 route so that the people who are affected during the 31 route could also make use of 32?
The 31 comes down the parkway and I guess lower Thurston Avenue, and the 32 comes down Trip Hammer. And if we take 32 off Trip Hammer, put it on the parkway, then you kind of just create the same situation for the folks on Trip Hammer Road. And to that end, we kind of got to pick one. The reason why we would hold on to, you know, Trip Hammer Road within Cayuga Heights instead of moving it over on the weekend is, when possible, we try and simplify routing so that the weekend and weekday versions are as close as possible. Though I know that's not always the case, and that, you know, my personal planning philosophy is to kind of move away from that, or at least differentiate better. On that note, I have gotten emails about kind of implying like a weekend of 31, and alternatively a downtown 31. We used to run the 31 downtown, yes, some of it is demand, but it also has to do with resource availability, right? The way we run the 77 is we try and use it to cover the 31's territory in Winston-Port and Etna. We also try and cover the 77, the 37's territory up in Lansing. And each one of those loops is going to cost us an hour just to get to the mall roughly. So if we instead run that 31 to downtown, maybe that'll cost us about an hour, but then Lansing won't have service. And it's a lot of give and take and who wins and who loses. And we try and, you know, balance public service and, you know, service equity is, you know.
Yeah, there's a lot of factors that go into how we plan routes, and we do look at service requests that we get from the community. So in spring of this year, we had another trip from Danby because we got a request. So we do go through the requests that we get from our members of the community, emails, phone calls, we catalog all them. And then if we see a large amount of requests for service in a specific area, specific time, we go through the process that Trevor just explained, where we see what we can do to add service or reallocate service to meet that demand. The problem that we have is because we're running less service than we were doing pre-COVID, it's a case of sometimes triaging, which, you know, to an extent all transit systems in the United States do, because they generally have not received as much funding as, say, roadway construction. But you know, you kind of have to try to match your resources to where you have the most amount of demand.
Yeah. Thank you for the presentation. This was a lot of really interesting data that I think we've all kind of been interested in hearing about. I wanted to ask what data or what way TCAT keeps track and tabs on overcrowding of buses, specifically to the extent that there are passengers maybe left on the curb, and like how that's mitigated.
Sure. So the first thing that happens whenever a bus driver and their bus is full and they're leaving people behind is they call dispatch, and then they inform dispatch of the situation and say, you know, I'm at Milstein Hall leaving seven behind. In an ideal world, we would then send another bus up to collect those seven. Unfortunately, you know, we oftentimes don't have that spare bus or spare driver. So then it gets noted in a dispatch report, and then it gets disseminated to service planning. They keep track on it. We also have a number of reports that we look at through automation. We have passenger counters on the vehicle, which essentially are beams of light. When you walk on or off the vehicle, when you interrupt the beam of light, it registers whether that's a passenger, a backpack, small child, and then it puts all those reports together, and we can look at the ridership, the trip, and determine, you know, when the ridership, you know, is reaching the point where it's turning people away. And then we also listen to customer complaints. You know, customers call in and say that a bus was overcrowded. We log that and we look at it for the next service change. So when I started, the 30 only ran every half hour, and it was constantly overcrowded, leaving people behind. We spent a lot of time repairing vehicles and recruiting aggressively, and we were able to double the frequency to every 15 minutes, which it still leaves people behind sometimes, but at least, you know, it's running more frequently than it was prior to that. So within the extent of our resource availability, we try our best to respond to those complaints, and we try our best to be proactive in monitoring them. But, you know, until we have a full complement of resources available to us, there's still going to be times of day where it's just kind of difficult to travel by public transit. You know, the rush hours are always very difficult.
Thank you for the presentation. I'm wondering if you have a feedback system that we can provide specific to some drivers or the bus that we have been traveling to.
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
I'm wondering about the feedback system that you have other than maybe the phone call, which it's usually not picked it up. Like specific to some drivers or the bus situation. So you have any feedback systems that we can provide to?
Yep, so any customer contact we log. So phone calls, feedback through the app. We get feedback notifications through our MyStop app. We get feedback notifications. So anything email gets logged, social media. So anytime a customer communicates with us in any medium, we log it. Drivers are an important source of communication, but some drivers are better than others. Some will relay everything that they get from a customer, and some don't really relay it very well at all. So I would say if there's something important you'd like us to be aware of, let us know through communication to TCAP. But the drivers generally do a good job at relaying things that they're seeing or hearing from customers.
Can I note something? There's also an online contact form on our website. So, you can tick off, whatever issue that's affecting you at the time. So it could be anything from, bus operator conduct or discomfort in the bus, et cetera. So right in under contact on the homepage.
Yes, you're in?
I'm Stella Knorton.
Oh, yes.
Hi, I have a question just regarding share box revenue. I noticed it was about 4%, which is a pretty dramatic increase from the pre-COVID environment. And especially given the fact that TCAP just invested pretty significantly in a new share box collection system, I was just wondering how, if there's going to be like any trend or change.
Yeah, I think we're expecting share box revenue in 2025 to be a lot stronger as we've have more mechanisms now to collect fare, and we're looking at expanding those mechanisms. So one of the features of the new fare box that we're gonna roll out at some point in 2025 will be open payment. So you can pay by credit card or phone, similar to what you see in New York City with the Omni system. The fare boxes have the hardware to do that. We just need to do some engineering on the software side. So that's one area we're gonna roll out. We had a lot of bumps in the road with the fare box project. So we had a wonderful fare box system before this fare box called the Ride Logic system that was actually developed by Cornell students. And it was a great piece of engineering that did everything in the world we wanted it to do and worked fantastically. But unfortunately, it began to age out. The hardware was old and the hardware couldn't be replaced. And we had to go with Genfare, which is a nationwide vendor. So their system was not catered to Ithaca at all. It was off the shelf. It's the same system you see in St. Louis or Lafayette, Louisiana. It's a nationwide system that most transit systems use except the really big operators. So there were a lot of issues integrating with our systems, integrating with the Cornell IDs, getting stock of the fare media. And there was a lot of periods where the new fare boxes weren't working well because we weren't upgrading from one Genfare system to another. We were going from totally separate system to a new system. It was a bit of a bumpy rollout. But we're through that now, and we're expecting to see stronger revenue. And typically, the less barriers you have to payment, the more people pay fares. So one of the things we're really excited about with open payment is something called fare capping. So fare capping means, say you pay with your credit card, and you ride the bus, 17 times in a month, it doesn't charge you for 17 single rides. At the point where you paid essentially in enough one rides for it to be a monthly pass, you automatically have a monthly pass. We'll recognize your credit card, and it just extends the monthly pass to you, which is really good for people who are on low income because they don't need to front all that money. and then they're not being penalized because they don't have all that money at the beginning of the month to bypass. So we're really excited about that. We've got a little bit of work we need to do on the software side, and we're hoping to work on that throughout the year. But that will also increase our Farebox revenue.
Yeah.
That's an incredible system. And do you have intents on advertising or otherwise letting people know about that particular aspect of it?
Oh yeah, we'll do a PR blast, certainly. We've been fairly quiet about it because we don't have a launch date yet. We're really waiting on the vendor and some internal things to get that done. But when it's ready and when we have a launch date, we will blast it out on social media and our local media outlets as well, and we'll make sure that Cornell and you all are notified as well.
Yes.
Sam Sokoloff, I was curious if there's like any sort of, I guess, grand, like big picture, something like that might be a political priority, something that requires collaboration with the county and the city, and Cornell maybe writ large, just towards like improving the system, getting more revenue and or frequency.
Well, it's great that you asked that because the timing couldn't be better as New York State is in budget season right now. So the way budget works is the governor presents their executive budget, and then there's a little bit of negotiating that goes on with the legislature, the House and the Senate in New York State, or the Assembly and the Senate, and then we're given a budget from that. Now, STOA is our bread and butter. That's our big operating funding. That is what makes it possible for us to provide service and more service. So the governor's executive budget right now has a 3% increase allocated for public transit. Now that's not adjusted for inflation, so 3% doesn't really go very far. Fuel is up a lot since, you know, we kind of got hit with two price hikes. One was in COVID, and then when the war in Ukraine started, there was another wave of inflation. And that hit things like fuel, lubricants, tires really hard, and you know, labor's gone up a lot because those put strain on your household budget. So then there's expectation from employees for more money. And on top of that, you know, as I've learned, I think today there's now a 25% tariff introduced on steel and aluminum, which will raise our operating costs a lot because buses are made out of steel and aluminum and they consume wheels that are made out of steel and aluminum. So we're going to get hit a little bit harder by that. So the 3% increase in STOA is a really good starting point, but it doesn't allow us to provide all of the service that we need in the community. We know there's a huge amount of unmet demand, both relating to Cornell and in, you know, the community at large. And this is a problem that's faced by all systems across the state. You know, I talked to all the other transit systems. Syracuse, they're trying to keep up with all the growth from Micron. Albany has growth in the SUNY schools from ridership. We have a lot of growth here within Cornell. We know that there's still a lot more service we need to put out on the road to meet demand at Cornell. You know, Buffalo's seen a lot of warehousing. That's the same thing in Broome County. So what the properties, the upstate properties are asking for from the state is a 15% increase in STOA. That would help help us meet all of our obligations. It would allow for a significant expansion of service, expansion of routes, expansion of hours. And we are asking that there would be a dedicated fund for that. Right now, STOA comes out of the state general fund. The state general fund's becoming increasingly unstable. So we would ask there be a dedicated source of revenue, whether that be an increase in motor vehicle registration fees, whether that be a fee on Ubers and Lyfts. There's a number of models. And these models are in effect downstate when they're used to fund the MTA. So we're asking that they take that same model and expand it to upstate like they did with the rental car surcharge. So I think what it would be critical, I guess, from a group like GPSA to do support is talk to your legislators and, you know, remind them of how important public transit is and all of the things that it does for you. And, you know, say that you would support an increase in state operating assistance. And, you know, we'd certainly be happy to co-author a letter with the GPSA or Cornell administration or co-author an editorial in some of the local newspapers. I think those are the ways to drum up a lot of political support. We have fantastic representatives here in Ithaca. Leah Webb and Anna Kellis are both extremely supportive of public transit and specifically the STOA program. But, you know, continuing to just reiterate how important public transit is in your life, I think it helps give a lot of weight to our argument. And I'm optimistic optimistic based on some of the conversations I've had with legislators. There seems to be a lot of support. Problem is, right now, there's a lot of uncertainty at the federal level. So we also get a lot of federal funding. We just don't know what's happening with the federal funding right now. It changes every day. But for us, it's scary, and it's especially difficult for capital because a lot of our buses are paid for with federal funds. 80% of the buses are federally funded. So that might not have an immediate effect, but it will hurt us as far as getting new buses and transitioning away from diesel to non-carbonized propulsion methods. There's a lot of anxiety right now, and I'm just very fortunate we live in a state that provides a lot of support for public transit because not all states do. When I lived in Wisconsin, the state provides almost zero. They provide zero operating support. And Kentucky is the same. We're not as dependent as some of the other systems, but what's going on with the federal government does cause a lot of uncertainty, and uncertainty is not good for any business or operation, really.
Paul Caruso. Got it. I have a comment and a question. The comment is to say thank you. I am aware from my perspective and also the perspective of other students that I know, we would be unable to get to class and to get to campus without the TCAT service at all. Just the place that we live in the city, we would not be able to even attend the university based on where our housing is. We wouldn't be able to get there, so thank you. And my question is just a point of personal curiosity. What relationship at all does TCAT have to Ithaca Regional Airport? And what kind of conversations are there? I know that they're trying to expand their own usership of the airport. Are there opportunities there to collaborate with them in providing TCAT service to the airport with assistance from them?
That's a good question. We are participating, I think, is it the strategic plan the airport's currently doing? We're working with them on that. We do have a relationship with them. We do not see a lot of ridership to the airport, believe it or not. We see sometimes when it's a change in semester, the airport routes get very busy. But for the most part, most of the ridership we see at the airport is actually more associated with rental cars than flights, people going there to get a rental car. It's an area I think we need to grow a little bit in, and Trevor's looking at doing some restructuring in that neighborhood that will allow for more reliable service, better on-time performance for the airport routes. But the biggest challenge we have is coordinating with the airplane schedules. And, people always say to me, well, why doesn't the bus arrive when the flight's there? And I will say, well, why doesn't the flight arrive when the bus is there? So you get in kind of this chicken and egg approach, and it's compounded by the fact that the air service at the airport is so infrequent that, we have to have a late night service. So, Trevor, is something he probably wants to add.
What I will say is the airplane schedule doesn't particularly help because we got flights out at 5 a.m. and we got flights back at 10 p.m., I want to say. I haven't used the airport that much, but I'm pretty sure that's how it works. The midday stuff, that as a thing. So when we add service at the very tail end or the start of the day, we have to be mindful that we have to be mindful of the union work rules. The drivers can only work for so long. They have to have so many hours in between their service days. And if we add a lot of service at either end,
inefficient.
Yeah.
From an operations standpoint, because you might be having a driver come in and only work a few hours because there's no other work that you can link up with that work at that time in the afternoon or evening. Certainly, we would be a lot more successful, I think, with airport ridership if there were more midday flights. But I know the airlines themselves are kind of moving away from the more rural service or EAS service or whatever they called it years ago. And they're really more focused on the main lines. We do interface a lot with the intercity bus carriers. We see a lot of, we're very fortunate because they operate out of Green Street, which is our main hub. So it's very easy to get to Flixbus or Trailways or one of the other carriers. But that's a good question. And certainly we want to be a part of the airport success.
I was just wondering, what's the threshold you have for canceling service due to snow or like adverse weather events? I know we've had several instances in the past few weeks where like buses have completely stopped running. So I was just wondering, what's the threshold you set for that?
So we don't have a specific threshold. And this year, We've canceled service 3 times. Last year, I think it was only once. It's a safety call. So we listen to what the operators are saying when they're calling in on the radio. We're listening to what our supervisors, some of which have been doing this for a very long time, are saying. And then the operations manager ultimately makes a call. And he's been in this business working for TCAT 14 years. And before that, he drove trucks and driven through all sorts of weather. So I tend not to second guess his calls. I think when he says, look, pull the plug for a little while, it's time to do that. But we've had a lot of issues this year. So the first suspension we did was zero visibility. I remember I was at the garage and we couldn't even see to Guthrie across the street. And a lot of drivers were calling in and they were just saying, it's not safe. I can't see where I'm going. I don't even know where I am. So, you know, that we pulled the plug on very quickly. That was very localized. So Newfield, you know, was fine, but Ithaca was a disaster zone. And then the city was caught a little off guard because it was unpredicted. It was actually lake effect snow from Seneca Lake, which is really rare in this area. The Finger Lakes don't usually produce snow, but they will have just the right wind. And the city wasn't prepared, so it took them a little bit of time to get their operators in to clear the roads. And I think it was, we had a Friday morning where we had, it was this Friday where we had ice. And ice is the worst enemy for a bus because their weight is so heavy in the back that they just tend to slide a lot when there's any ice on the road. And then Sunday or Saturday night, we had a suspension. So with all three of those, the problem was that State Street and Aurora Street got blocked with cars that had either crashed or cars that were stuck. And when we can't get up State or Aurora, specifically State, I mean, it just cuts off most of our access to campus. And the last thing we want to do is have, you know, them trying to pull a car out of the side of a ditch. And then there's 4 or 5 buses stuck because it's a lot harder to recover a bus than a car. So we make the decision and we learn. So we learned from the first time we suspended service this year that we probably could have gotten service running a little faster. Then it took us a little too long to restore service. So we learned those lessons and we applied them to Saturday night. So hopefully, you know, those will be the last few times we've had to suspend service. Snow event, as long as it's not too windy, we can operate. It's just really when the snow starts to outpace what the local roadway crews can keep up with. And some are very good. The state is really good at clearing the roads. But, you know, the city of Ithaca takes a little longer. They don't have as much of the heavy-duty equipment the state has. So they're a little slower, and they have a lot more alleys and streets that are really inefficient for them to plow. So it takes them a lot longer. So we really just kind of have to make a judgment call based on what we're hearing, what we're observing. And it's not an easy call. And we do have discussion at each time after we suspend service. Was it the right call? How quickly did we get buses back on the road? What could we have done better? So we do treat it as a learning experience, and it's something that we want to do as a last resort, but we don't want there to be an accident where anyone's hurt or equipment's damaged or a driver feels stressed out because you know, it's just not worth the risk of that.
Sorry, I was gonna say I know you mentioned previously you had electric buses that had mechanical issues, and then now you're looking at adding a few new ones. What have you been able to do kind of to mitigate what the new ones are going to have?
Sure. So the old electric buses we had were built by a company called Proterra, which was an early adopter of the technology, and they were using a new technology which was a fiberglass body and frame for the vehicle. And they did that to offset the weight of the batteries because the batteries are really heavy electric buses. But unfortunately, being an early adopter, and we were an early adopter of electric buses, we took on some of the risk. That technology wasn't proven and the frames fell apart and the company Proterra went bankrupt and we can't get support for the vehicles anymore. So we're in a little bit of a pickle with those vehicles. The new electric buses we're getting are from a company called Gillig. And Gillig has been manufacturing buses for TCAT for almost as long as we've been operating. I've worked with Gillig's at all the properties. They're a very good bus. They were very slow to put out an electric bus because they wanted a bus that would be really reliable and durable for their customers. But instead of a balsa wood and fiberglass frame, they have a traditional steel frame that you'd find on a diesel bus. So even they're going to be very heavy. That's the downside. But we're not going to see frame issues, and the power system is built by Commons, who builds diesel engines, so we'll know we'll have local support for it. We had one of the buses out as a demonstrator. I drove it. We looked at it. We put it on a lift. So we're very optimistic that these buses will be more reliable than our Proteras, and that will be, you know, competitive with diesels. The problem with electric buses, and I'm not against electric buses, they have a lot of advantages. They don't have noise pollution. They don't have tailpipe pollution. They drive faster. They're much more power on the hills, but they're not yet a one-to-one replacement where you can replace one diesel with an electric bus. One electric bus, you need about 1.5 or 1.25 diesels because they have a lot more downtime when they're trying to charge. And our big problem in this area is we don't have the electricity infrastructure to charge them really quickly like you see in other properties. So, you know, where NYSEG has been a little, the infrastructure in this area is a little bit more dated than what you see out west. And it's a big challenge to support six or seven electric buses all charging rapidly at once. So basically means that we won't be able to run them 18, 20 hours a day like we run the diesels, but we're still gonna get some really good usage out of them, and you'll probably see them on campus a lot where they run really efficiently.
Thank you.
Andy?
We've had conversations with Cornell about expanding its first year policy to an opt-in system to free up passes for students to use the bus frequently. Is there anything logistically on TCAT's side that would make that a challenge?
We would have to probably look at our service level agreement and speak with Cornell about that. But, you know, we're open to whatever model Cornell would be interested in using for students to you know, increase transit usage. We know there's a big parking burden on campus right now, and we want to be a part of reducing that. So I think, you know, we're happy to be flexible regarding that. So we really kind of just defer to what Cornell's policy is on what they'd like to do. You know, many universities across the state are going to full open access, where if you're a student, you know, it's just baked into your student fee. And that, because of the bulk, it allows the university to negotiate a really low fee for the pass. So, you know, SUNY Albany does that. I think they're paying something like, it's a formula, but it's estimated as if each student who rode paid about 35 cents a ride. So, but because they have so many students, they can negotiate that bulk payment. So, you know, certainly we're open to, you know, that, but, you know, we defer to Cornell and their policy. They've been doing this a long time. So whatever model they feel is appropriate, we'd be happy to accommodate.
Yeah. I recall on your slide, you had ridership broken down by route, but I was curious about the net percentage of ridership that you attribute to Cornell affiliates.
It's a very tricky number to say, because, you know, we don't track, say, is someone affiliated with Cornell, yes or no, are they a rider? We have some vague idea based on how many Cornell cards are swiped at the red box. But, you know, some of those individuals may be making a trip unrelated to Cornell, might be getting groceries. And then you might have a spouse of someone who's Cornell affiliated. And you have staff, you have, you know, non-academic staff and academic staff. And then you have all of this ancillary activity related to Cornell that generates ridership. So someone that might work in a business, they might not be affiliated with Cornell at all, but they might work for a business that's affiliated with Cornell. So it's difficult to track, but, you know, I would say, you know, I would estimate it's probably 60-70% of our ridership is in some way affiliated with Cornell. We know that based on when we hit the vacations, the holidays, and the summer, you know, how quiet it gets. So, you know, Elmira Corning is a similar service area, and they run about 19 buses. So, you know, they're that's, you know, we're probably about twice the size of a transit system in this part of the country in a community of Ithaca size. So, you know, that's only possible because of the shared resources Cornell provides, but also all of the activity provided by Cornell and Ithaca College as well, which is a partnership that's really starting to grow last year.
I guess my question would be, I mean, I'm potentially aware that there may be some limitations for you when it comes to answering this stuff, but what would you say are some things in which, like, this university has been very helpful with when it comes to like supporting TCAT, and what are some areas of support or improvement in which like university can further contribute to the operations?
So, you know, I'd say that if you look at our sources of operating funding and you don't look at the CARES and CRISA, because those were one time off, outside of STOA, you know, the Cornell Service Level Agreement is probably our biggest source of operating funding. So that is a very significant contribution that most transit systems don't have that that contribution, as well as Cornell being one of our underwriters, which means that they provide one third of the local match with the city and the county. So I think continuing to grow that partnership, whether it's through, you know, service level agreement or whether it's through the underwriters' contributions, is probably the best way that Cornell can contribute to TCAT. And, you know, a lot of the things that Cornell does, they've made some decisions that have really helped TCAT. Like, they've made decisions, unlike other universities, not to build parking garages, which helps generate, it helps keep the campus beautiful and helps keep the campus quiet and clean because you don't have cars backed up everywhere, but it also helps generate ridership on TCAT. You know, I mean, I think the biggest challenge we see in the community now is housing, both for our employees, but also as lower income housing gets pushed further and further out, that becomes very difficult for us to serve. So, you know, I know Cornell provides a lot of assistance politically, you know, to building more housing in the area. And that's really important too for the success of public transit. But Cornell does provide a lot more support to TCAT than most transit systems get from the universities in their area. And, you know, TCAT, we're a third really Cornell, because we're a third CU transit. The old CU transit kind of merged with the other two. So, you know, Cornell's a strong partner, and I think just continuing to grow that partnership will be very beneficial to everyone.
There are no other,
yes. Like, how does TCAT communicate with like Google Map or these kind of apps to track the bus, and which one works like most accurate?
So the most accurate app is our MyStop app, which I understand is not the easiest to use, a little dated, but that is by far the best and most accurate data. We publish a GTFS feed, which is general transit specification feed, or general transit speed specification, and we send that out to Google, and then that gets ingested by all the third-party apps. And we had a little glitch for a little while where it wasn't sending the real-time data, but it's back to sending the real-time data as to where the buses are located in real time. But MyStop is the best, is by far the best way to get it. I would say if you don't want to use MyStop, Google is a close second. The third-party apps, we don't make any endorsement of them. Some of them have the same, they ingest the same data Google does. Some don't. So, you know, we're kind of a little bit, I'd say use at your own risk if you're using something outside of Google or MyStop, because we control the data we send to Google. And if something doesn't look right, we can go in and fix it. But we don't have a control over what third party apps are doing.
Yes.
Strange. So I know a lot of other universities close down their main street that kind of runs through campus. That was how it was in my undergrad, and that really helped the bus flow on campus especially. And I just walking around, there's massive delays whenever it seems like a lot of buses get stuck there. So has that been a discussion item, just like closing down any during main campus hours or maybe?
Not that I'm aware of, but you know, Cornell has a pretty robust parking and transportation department and also a planning department. That's all under facilities. So I'm sure that's something that, you know, we could discuss with them. Reducing car traffic would certainly improve the speed of buses on campus, but believe it or not, the type of traffic that slows us down the most is actually pedestrian traffic. During a class change, it can become very hard, and we tell the drivers just to reduce their speed significantly, and if they can't make a turn, then they just wait. So typically what we see is, you know, like the 81 will run very late during class change, and then it makes up that time when classes are in session, and then this cycle kind of just happens all day. And the drivers kind of just get used to it, but, you know, it's just one of the challenges of operating in a campus environment. But, you know, Cornell has a very beautiful campus, and they have not ripped up a lot of it to add additional car lanes or parking, unlike, you know, I'm from Buffalo. SUNY Buffalo is a very auto-oriented campus that is probably much more difficult for transit operators because you have these huge parking lots and highways that you have to get across. So I think, you know, the way that the geography of the Cornell campus helps us a lot in services we provide.
We can take one more question.
Just from like an ops perspective, it's kind of more of an abstract question. Like in looking at like kind of the bottlenecks that you see, like how far from like a perfect utilization where like your system's falling at 100%, no problem. Like how far off do you think? Obviously, we can't get there because
I think, you know, it depends on what way you mean. Like, you mean as far as like on time performance, making the bus on time, or just running reliably, running most efficiently, growing back to where we were.
Whatever aspect of the system is like functioning at its lowest, like level of holding everything else back, if that was at its capacity to meet all demand, like how far off
is it? So I think our biggest constraint right now is equipment.
Okay.
The older equipment and the difficulties we're having maintaining older equipment. If we had a fleet that was in really good shape, and consequently if we had enough drivers to operate that fleet, you know, we could probably increase service by, you know, 40%,
okay,
I would say. You know, so I would say that that would mean much better service on weekends, late nights, and much better rush hour service. Because, you know, we have the not all things are equal. So if you can have a lot of drivers and driver hours, you know, you can allocate whenever you need them. But vehicle hours, you know, it's really hard to increase your vehicle hours during rush hour because you have all the vehicles on the road. So if we had better, if we had a better fleet, a newer fleet, it would certainly mean that we could run a lot more service during the mornings and the evenings and less weight, less crowding.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming by to GBSA.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. Thank you for your support. We're always happy to do a tour of the garage if anyone would be interested. I'll certainly let OSHA know, and you know, we can relay their information, but we'd be happy to have the group down for an organized tour so you can see how TCAT works and how we repair all the buses and everything like that. So we'd love to have you guys down if there's interest. So thank you very much.
We can get that coordinated for sure. Just let me know if there's enough interest, then we can relay that to TCAT and have that happen for the same trip. As for the presentation, I know you shared it with me, but is it all right if we share it with the rest of the body here? Or
yes. No? Yep, okay. That's fine.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. And now back to a regularly scheduled program. We have a legislation. I mean, sorry. We have a legislation. So this is resolution number 7, the revision of graduate and professional student assembly bylaws. Sponsored by Xander Lynch, VP of Operations. So, Xander, whenever you're ready, you can go ahead and give your meetings.
All right. So, I would like to first say that it's sponsored by Xander Lynch and the Operations Committee, because everybody on the Operations Committee had. I really appreciated it. And also, special shout out to Nick, who was doing this last year and made me continue doing it this year. Okay, so the main things that changed in this, or that we're trying to change in this revision of the bylaws is, so section 3, so the main thing in section 3 is that there was like endless repetition of like the things that make up a committee, and they were the exact same thing. So one thing that Nick did was to cut all that down and just make it into, I believe, this section 3.01, which is the responsibilities for all committees, which just kind of like takes all that redundancy and makes it so that we don't have to see it repeated 100 times. I think there were minimal changes to specific committee like responsibilities or duties. I think one specific one was that there was, who was it? The Student Advocacy Committee. We did remove some of the wording that was there that might step on the union's toes, basically. Like we removed wording about them being responsible for stipend or health insurance or anything like that, where it's very clearly a union matter. We also updated under the 3.03 operations and staffing committee. So we updated the list of like liaisons and external positions because that hadn't been updated in a while, and there were many that were like literally didn't even make sense. Like they just didn't exist anymore. So also thanks to Jessica for assistance with figuring out who was still around and working of those committees. And then, so that's most of section three. And then looking at section four, so we just changed how a couple of different things worked in here, basically just to bring them up with what we actually already do. So, for example, last semester we had to call an additional meeting so that President Kotlikoff could come and talk to us. And the previous wording was that we needed written permission from 2/3 of all seated voting members. We did not do that. We just had like a vote here, and that also seemed to work a lot better because hopefully most people are coming to this meeting. And so that we thought that was the best way to get that meeting scheduled. So that's one of the things. There was some stuff about absences. I've been taking care of a lot of the like coordinating, like who goes where, like who's part of which committees, and keeping track of like absences and that kind of stuff. So we changed that from the executive vice president to my role, which is the vice president of operations. So I think that's mostly everything in four.
I just wanted to add that I understand this printout can be kind of difficult to see what's changed and what's remaining the same, but the version on box should have full bold and strike through for all changes proposed. And that'll be up for at least a full week until we vote on.
Yeah.
Again, I think the PDF does not have.
Google
Doc.
The Word doc should have it.
Yeah.
Maybe Jessica, can you like show everyone how to get to that also? Once we have it figured out, so that will have all of the strike throughs, all of the changes, everything that we did to the bylaws. If you have any questions, you want to see if like we hid something in there, you can feel free to go through it. It's generally pretty straightforward and often quite boring, if I am telling the truth. Finally, in section five, this was reworked slightly because we were worried that like basically it gave the executive committee like full power over GPSA elections, including if they were running in the elections, which seemed strange to us. The main place where that changed is, oh, actually that's still a section four area. Well, I edited it on Saturday or on Sunday, so it should be in here.
You want to get a quick summary on what that is?
I want to see if it got in there. Oh, sorry. Okay, so this is back in section 3.04. Sorry about that. I was reviewing the plaque. Okay. What I changed was mainly the constitution. In section 3.04, part B, the constitution. So, the executive committee shall serve as the elections committee. Okay, that's fine. But what I included, or what I changed, was members of the executive committee that are running in any given election are to recuse themselves. If this excludes the entire executive committee, the executive committee will choose a GPSA member to chair this effort who shall be approved by a majority vote of GPSA voting members. So this gives us, so the executive committee still chooses the representative, but it gives the general body a chance to like be like, yes, that's not someone who's totally in the pocket of the executive committee or something. So hopefully that just brings a little more like clarity and like less like shadiness to the election process.
And even though these haven't been like passed per se and stuff, we are using the spirit of like this practice for this current election. For example, I am the current chairperson for the elections committee as I'm graduating this semester, so I will not be having that conflict of running again because I can't legally, unless if you want to change that for me. But yeah, that's like what we mean by making sure that like there's less conflicts of interest in general. So if you want to make sure that these elections are as fair and efficient as possible.
So yeah, so feel free to take a look. Let me know if you have any questions, either now, over the next couple of weeks, or at the next meeting. And like I said, there's still a couple of things that didn't seem to have fully made it, like strike through that should have been removed that don't seem to be. And there's still a couple of grammatical errors, but these are broadly what we'll be voting on at the next meeting.
Any questions, comments, and or concerns? As a friendly reminder, we are not voting on this now. We'll take this a quick preview appetizer before we vote on it next time.
Did you have a question?
Yeah, I have. So you didn't want us to point out the errors in this document?
No, you can point out the errors in this document.
Section 3.1 has just the letter T for one of the points.
Yeah.
I'm ahead of you. I know.
Yeah, so we can cut that one. Thank you very Section 3.10.
I bet.
3.10. Yeah, I believe we go. Okay. So this is a lot of these are artifacts of the fact that we were trying to create a strike through document so that people could see what changes. And so I think a lot of stuff got like added that we didn't need to. Yeah.
It was already agreed upon. All right.
Any other?
Oh yeah, no. Any other questions?
I have a question.
Yeah.
So the question in section 3.08 and 3.1111, where we discuss about student advocacy and DISC, both seem to work on issues of diversity. I think it's mentioned for student advocacy that they work for diversity. So is that the function of this that, you know, the name itself says it's for diversity. So is that like a repetition?
You're asking if there's like any like difference or is there a way to make a book between
the business? Yeah.
I think mine is
So
my understanding for DISC and for student advocacy and stuff, advocacy in its name is like exclusively like activism based and stuff, any kind of things that are like more of a resolution based or any way in which you can like have that graduate school overall and stuff. This can have some overlap with student advocacy in that sense. If anything, there could be some resolutions where they can collaborate together per se if it's related to diversity. But this is not solely just only the advocacy kind of things. It's also about the celebration. They host a lot of events. They help out support clubs and organizations with certain events as well to promote that diversity aspect. So yes, there's some overlap in that sense, but this is not exclusively just advocacy on things, if that makes sense.
If I could also make the statement, you bring up a really good point, and this is something we've been discussing in executive board meetings, but I think the intention with this bill was to like separate out like the actual structural changes to GPSA that would actually change how we run from clerical issues that make this document less unwieldy. And one of which is like, how do we interface with the union now? One way is potentially reformulating student advocacy around university policy, for example, which has been the focus of student advocacy over the past year, and letting DIS retain its kind of domain in diversity, inclusion initiatives, celebration initiatives, things like that. So to bring up a strong point, I'm hoping we can bring up a new bill that will address that.
Yeah. So just get going off of that, we only wanted to make within the operations committee changes that were of a like logistic nature or of a like clarifying nature to for us to us as the operations or us as the executive board to unilaterally change the missions of committees seems like a bad idea to me. That's why. So if there are things like that, that is great. Those are great things to bring to me or to email me or to bring to the next meeting, because those will be important jumping off points for when we for if we decide to reformulate some of these committees as a broader body.
Any other questions? Yes, Irene.
I understand with student advocacy the need for removing finance and stipend levels. Did childcare also is that something that we also move towards like the union or what's going on there?
I believe so because I believe that's terms of employment. And so we can't touch anything that would be remotely employment.
What I will say is that the University Assembly does have their own committee called Campus Welfare Committee, and they touch base on child support as well. So if you say self alone can't do anything, then the University Assembly as a whole can help out with that. And we are part of the University Assembly.
Got you. Yeah. Thank you.
Of course. Shout out to Ava. Any other questions, comments, and or concerns? Emphasis on concerns. If not, yes, Jessica?
Do you want me to show how to get to this inbox?
Yes, please.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, so what Jessica has up here for us right now is this, but if it wasn't so clean. It has all of the strike-throughs, everything that that was removed or added or anything like that. And so you can see what the original wording was for this.
Motion to extend the meeting by 10 minutes.
Motion to extend has been made. Is there a second? Seconded by everyone and the mothers. Is there any dissent? Seen by nobody. All right. Thank you. That is passed. Great. 6:35 is the new time to end. Any other questions, comments, and concerns?
Jessica was going to show us that.
Oh yes, Jessica.
So here's your box holder for graduate and professional student assembly. So when you open it, you'll see your governing documents and other things, but this is where the bulk of your material is. Academic year 2025. Each meeting has its own folder. And in each folder, you have your agenda, the minutes that you're going to be reviewing. Here's the slides. Wow, thank you, Ocean. And a subfolder for legislation. So here you can see them. And you can see that Nicholas added the Word, and then Eric turned it into a PDF. That's so we can print the packets, but then we lost your resign. So that didn't work today. But that was the intention. So that's the way to find it.
Thank you, Jessica.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. All right. Please review through the legislation much further. We'll be voting on this in our next meeting for GPSA, which is February 24th, I believe. And with that, we'll now move over into new business. At the moment, there's nothing listed per se for new business, but as mentioned, the executive committee updates, we do have a vacancy for the Diversity and International Students Committee chair position. In the interest of time, because we do want to make sure that the committee can still continue on, we are looking for nominations for that committee chair position. So if there's any motions for those nominations, please. Yes.
Open the floor.
Yep. All right. So moved. Is there any second?
Second.
Is there any dissent? Seeing none, that motion passes. Accepting the nomination, starting with Nicholas Brennan.
I'd like to nominate Alicia George for district leader.
All right, Alicia George has been nominated. Alicia, do you accept?
Yes.
All right, Thank you for that. Do we have any other nominations on the floor? Entertaining a motion to close the floor for nominations. All right. Andy? All right, is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by everybody. Is there any dissent? Seeing none. All right. Congratulations, Lisa. You're yay. That's it.
So I just wanted to make an announcement about, so TCAT had a really great presentation, but I also wanted you guys to know that there's that the union actually also met with TCAT. So if there's anything that you guys really want to see change, like what Matthew was saying about how there's like a opt-in, opt-out thing that we've suggested that the university do, or also the other universities do, like open, like if you're a student, you get to ride the bus for free and do like a bulk thing like that, just to let us know and we'll do our best. We've been trying really hard to like touch on the things that we can, but ultimately there's some things that the union is going to have both at the other, but just know that your union is already on holiday.
And in it, yes,
yeah.
Yeah.
Apart from that, no, I'll be quick because I know we want to leave. Maybe actually I'll just talk to you about it after.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Just want to say, in addition, as mentioned by Matthew, if there's any interest in creating resolution of some sorts, to create that open letter to send over to any of our political leaders, sent by GPSA, or by, with the union or any others, we can work together to make that happen. The presentation itself has been uploaded to the box. You can go into GPSA's, specifically February 10th, since that's when the meeting happened. You can take a look at it. It's called February 25th CG slides. I don't know why it's called CG, but that's what it's called. And all the data that was presented in that meeting is readily available for y'all now. Yeah, there's nothing else for new business, so we'll now move into our open forum. That's where anyone can talk about anything today we should talk about and stuff. Yes, Ava.
I will also make this really quick. So I'm the chair of the university assembly. We have a committee called Campus Welfare Committee. Funny enough, they came up tonight. The chair of that committee is Christian Tarala. He is looking for Tarala. He's looking for members to join that committee, and GPSA could send some people there. So if you're interested in being on the UA Campus Welfare Committee, I have a net ID for you to email, and that is CT665. Please join. Please. Please.
You can reach out to me independently. You don't have to go through me for this one.
CT665.
CT. Thank you. Like the scam.
Like the scam. Thank you.
Do you have anything else for open agenda? Seeing none, entertaining a motion to, yes.
And motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn has been made. Is there a second? Seconded by the end. Is there any dissent? No dissent. Thank you.
Awesome. Like someone better.